It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Sandy Rios with you, coming to you live from the Cove. We've been here all week. It has been absolutely beautiful. Really, the weather and everything, and mostly the people. What an encouragement, and much needed. I wish each and every one of you could be with us here to sort of look at the beautiful mountains that we're looking at and just be refreshed. Not only we're eating a lot, but we're having great fellowship, and I think just remembering that God is above all of the politics and all the news that we talk about every single day, and for that we're grateful. Well, in a few minutes, the Benham brothers are going to join us, and we're going to have some fun. Remember, I talked to them at the Republican National Convention in July in Cleveland, and we had a good time, but I have some surprise questions for them today, so we're going to have some fun, so be sure that you stay tuned. But this is my third year to be at the Cove, and every year there's been this young man at the keyboard playing and leading us in worship, and I have loved it. And I tell you, I'm a hard sell. I am a hard sell. Just because to me, worship is not just sound. It's something that happens to our hearts and our minds as we come before the Lord and really magnify Him. And people that are musicians are not necessarily able to lead you into worship. Worship is separate from musical acumen. But Brian Eads has both, and I just appreciate him. And I asked him to sit down and talk to us. Brian is getting his PhD at Indiana University. In fact, do you have it already, Brian?
Not yet.
You're like 20, what, short?
20, 30, 40, 70 pages.
Oh, pages.
Yeah, I've written a good portion of it already. I just have to tie it.
What's
tie
it on?
It. It's on, actually, a German conductor named Fritz Steinbach, who is closely associated with the works of Johannes Brahms, particularly the orchestral works. Steinbach was a conductor of the Meiningen Court Orchestra in Germany and became particularly known for his interpretation of the Brahms symphonies. And Brahms himself actually sanctioned and approved a lot of Steinbach's markings and interpretive decisions. And so Steinbach kind of became known as the accepted interpreter of the music of Johannes Brahms. So I'm studying Steinbach's score markings and offering those writings as a more historically informed perspective on how to perform the music of Brahms.
Has this been fun for you, or has it become a grind after these?
Both.
How many years have you worked on it?
Both. It's been about 2 years, 2 years underway.
You know, it's hard for us as Westerners and Americans particularly to understand the importance of that kind of music to the German culture and to Western Europe, you know, during that time, where people were so, I think, arguably so much better educated, and their tastes were so, you know, even the stories of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his family, and he's known for as a pastor, but he was also a musician. Right. All of his family, it was just woven into their fabric. So that's a rich history of Western civilization that we're missing.
Very rich indeed.
You know, Brian, when you were a kid, how did you discover the classics? Were your parents into this?
Well, no, not at all. My family made up of bluegrass and gospel musicians. So I remember distinctly going over to my great-grandmother's house quite often, maybe once a month, once every 2 months. And my great-grandparents and great-uncles and nieces and nephews, we would have pickings, you know. And so somebody would bring an instrument. And I remember distinctly my great-grandfather and his three sons would just gather around the piano. And they could not read a lick of music. But if it had a string on it, they could play it. And as a young child, I could hear some of the tunes and go to the piano and pick them out. So my mother noticed that, and I started taking piano lessons when I was 8. But really, I wasn't very familiar with classical symphonic rep. I mean, I studied the piano, and so I studied piano works of Bach and Beethoven and Mozart and Brahms. And it really wasn't until my college years that I really started discovering the symphonic works of those great composers and fell in love with them.
Brian, you know, I was a music major, which is so irrelevant to what I do now, but I had a similar story, and my parents were not educated, but I was early a musician. I had a very keen ear, and you know, so all of that. But I went to college to major in music, and sitting in music history classes, they'd start talking about these things, and so many of the students had knowledge. I had no knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
It's like learning world history. You're going to take this one class, you're going to learn the history of the world, and you're going to learn the history of music. I felt very intimidated and really ill-equipped.
Oh, I was in the same boat. Yeah. I felt the same way because I was not in the orchestral world, in the opera world, I was not exposed to all of that rep until later on in college and then graduate work. And so I had a lot of catch-up work to do in that regard. So
we should say that you are a writer and a composer and a conductor. Is your PhD in conducting?
It's orchestral conducting.
Yeah.
Doctor of Music in orchestral conducting.
Very fun.
Yeah. It's great. It's fantastic.
And now we should say that you are just recently now in Nashville at help me. Which church is it?
Well, I'm not a member yet, but I've started attending a church there, Brentwood Baptist Church, and just know a lot of, made a number of friends there
at the
church.
And it's like a cavalcade of stars in the Christian the music scene in Nashville. I know
some of the people I've met have just been incredibly, but also not only they're incredibly gifted, but so giving and loving and accepting, and it's been very rewarding and comforting and encouraging to find a Christian family so quickly.
Yeah, so, okay, about that part. Brian, you heard my introduction of you, and I mean that. A lot of people are good musicians. So much of what's called worship in the church is not worship. In fact, it's distracting noise. It's really hard for me, I have to tell you. Sometimes I sit in a service, and I just pray that God will, you know, creating me a clean heart, and not, I'm just getting angry and frustrated and like, oh, you know, because worship is something that's indescribable. It's not something you can turn on a dime. It's not something you can manufacture. It's not to do with noise. And it is something that comes from a person's heart and the understanding of the majesty of God and expressing that in the limited ways that we have. Okay, so that doesn't come without knowing him. So I want to know how it is that you came to have that understanding of who God is and be able to lead us in worship like that?
Well, I think anything that happens in corporate worship on Sunday mornings or Sunday evenings or on Wednesday evening meetings has to be out of an overflow of what has happened in our individual lives every day of the week. I'm not perfect. I'm no saint. I wish I could say that every day I have spent 6 hours in scripture and in prayer. But I do make it a point to every day to try to have some type of just personal communion and relationship with the Lord. And whether that's in scripture and just not letting go of the priority of scripture in our lives. I mean, it has to be there. It's our life. It's our bread. It's our food. It's our meat. We cannot survive without it. And maintaining a constant attitude of prayer and just knowing him and having those individual times of worship in your own life and personal walk with the Lord. And I really do believe that that has to be in place, or that needs to be in place.
Has to be. I'll go with the first one.
Yeah.
Has to be. Brian, where did that start, though, with you? I mean, your folks, you said they were musicians, bluegrass musicians. They didn't read music, but were they Christ followers? Did you grow up in a Christian home?
I grew up in a Christian home, and I remember from a very early age. In fact, some of my earliest memories were in church. And I can remember actually being absolutely enamored with the music minister and what he got to do and the musicians that were playing. I remember so many times going to sit with the organist at the organ bench and just watching what she did, and going to watch the pianist. My mom tells a story when I was, I don't know exactly how old I was, but fairly young, that I was on the pew, and all of a sudden she looked over to the right and looked at me, and I was standing in the pew conducting the hymns. With the music.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
Listen,
I
do. Well, I've seen it, that God really does reveal our gifts early.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can tell a lot of times very, very early in a child's life which direction they're going to go.
I just gravitated towards it very early. Yeah. And even as a youth in the youth program, while all my other friends were outside either playing or, you know, whatever, I wanted to be with the choir. I wanted to just sit and watch. And there was just a draw to worship and what was going on that as I look back on it, I can see how God used that to ground me and to form a desire and a passion for that.
So. I totally relate to that. I'm so much older than you are, but I remember my parents came to Christ late. So church was new to us. And I remember going to Wednesday night prayer meeting, taking my doll and my pillow. And I could read music. So my dad was a bass, and he couldn't read music. So I would sing the bass line in his ear. And then when I got older, I would turn the pages in the citywide music festivals. I'd be the page turner, you know. God just placed it in my heart early. Brian, the thing about you, though, that's interesting and fun is that you are a great musician. And you really are very gifted. God has gifted you in many ways. But you are also a political junkie. Explain that to me. Explain how that started.
You know, I don't really know other than I got very, very involved in my undergraduate work at Delta State. And just on a personal
Delta
level,
State?
Delta State in Cleveland, Mississippi.
Okay.
I was never involved in any, you know, organized political groups on campus or anything like that. But it kind of became a personal study of mine and a personal passion of mine just to keep up and be involved and be informed.
Were your parents, did they do that? Did they talk politics at the dinner table?
Not really. It was just something that I found interest in. I was very, very curious about. And I didn't have the number of people that I was surrounded with. I didn't have many people that offered differences of opinion. We all kind of basically thought the same. But when I went to grad school and now in my doctorate and just living life with people of so many different backgrounds and beliefs, it's really solidified my own. And it's caused me to endeavor, okay, person A believes this. Well, why? You know, what has led him or her to these conclusions? And to really understand the framework and the worldview of how people come to certain conclusions and how it affects their politics. And so that's just been a personal interest of mine, and I followed in the news and everything that's going on. So.
Brian, you know that there's a pretty big divide between evangelical parents and their kids, and grandparents especially. The millennial mindset to many of us in another generation is certainly on the moral issues is off course. Right. And so we have a different view. It's almost like we live sometimes in alternate universes. Mm-hmm. I can't say that that's different than it was with us and our parents, the hippie generation. You know, our parents weren't raised with television or, much of radio, and there was a huge gap with us, too. Right. But do you find yourself sort of trying to straddle that? Because you have a mature old soul, kind of. I don't mean old, but you know what I'm saying. So, but you are a millennial, and your peers are. So how would you see bridging that gap, and do you have trouble negotiating that?
I'll answer it in two parts. One of the things that I think has helped ground me and given me some stability, I get in the work that I do, I get to hang around multiple different generations. So I really love ministering to people of all age groups. And so I think just hearing voices and hearing concerns and hearing what matters to people of all generations really has informed me and been able to relate to people of all different groups and different ages.
Well, Brian, it's just a joy to be with you again here Cove, and we look forward to it. I wish we could play something of you playing. We need a piano in this lobby, but we don't have one. But maybe we can find something and play it by the time this airs. Brian,
thanks,
we wish you the best. Brian Eads, remember that name because he's going to be somebody. I know he is. He already is somebody in the Lord, but I mean somebody on this earth.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thanks,
great
Brian.
To be here.
Yeah. All right, Sandy Rios coming back next with the Benham Brothers. Do not go away. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you, and we're live at the Cove, which is fun. And actually, everyone's in the dinner line. We're missing dinner to talk to you, so I hope you appreciate this. But we've had so much fun, and we could miss a meal. It wouldn't hurt. But my guests might not want to miss this meal, David and Jason Bennett. I saw them and interviewed them at the Republican convention in July, and that was great fun. We had fun. And so they are speaking for us tonight, and I asked if they could come early and talk to me. So they said yes, and here they are. All right, let me just say again, people know your name, but I don't think they know everything that you've done, so indulge me. Former professional baseball players, nationally acclaimed entrepreneurs, best-selling authors of whatever the cost, but they have a new book called Living Among Lions. I think we talked about that last time we spoke. And, of course, their business success has won numerous awards, so much so that they were offered a show on HGTV, and then we all know that it was pulled at the last minute because of their stand on marriage and life, and that was just an anathema. So they took the plunge with all of our other brothers who are paying a big price for their personal faith. But, all right, that's just some of your resume. But I want to ask you guys, of all those things that you've done, and I'm not talking about spiritually, I'm talking about on a human level, which of those things are you most proud of? David, you first.
Well, Matthew 5:11, Jesus is very clear in his word. He says, blessed are you when men persecute you and falsely accuse you. He says, rejoice and be glad, for they did the same to your fathers. The thing is that Jason and I, in the middle of all the business accomplishments and then even playing professional baseball and other things like this, one of the things that we truly look back at is what people think that was probably one of the worst things that happened to us, which is losing our show. But we look back and realize, you know what? That actually is a badge of honor. Because it wasn't our attitude. It wasn't anything that they found online that was a skeleton in the closet. It was the fact that we believe that life begins at conception and marriage is between a man and a woman. And as a result, we lost our television show for it. So with the right perspective, according to the scripture, that actually is a badge of honor. It's a badge of courage.
Okay,
and we
Sandy,
thank God for it.
Can I give you the non-spiritual answer?
Yes, okay. Yes, Jason, go
okay,
for
so
it.
Okay, so if we're just talking from an accomplishment standpoint, number one would be the fact that we both married girls that are way out of our league. And all of our kids, as of right now, have accepted Christ into their hearts, which is awesome.
We got to disciple them.
I would say on the accomplishment side, outside of family, outside of faith, is probably building a global business, building companies across the world. That, to me, is more of an accomplishment because playing professional baseball and being able to stand up and speak on stage and those types of things, sometimes, those are gifts. But to actually run a company that's successful involves a lot of hard work. It involves you being systematized, streamlined, having processes in place, creating something where other people can be successful and learning how to succeed through others. So creating the businesses and having those things operate on their own, I'm proud of that. I give God the credit, but
well,
I like
yeah,
it.
That's all right. I mean, God gives us gifts, and we're supposed to have an accurate view of ourselves.
Yes.
Not think more highly than we should,
that's
but
right.
An accurate view. Like I'm not a worm. I'm a worm. That's not what He asks us to do. We know what we do well. We certainly know what we don't do well. So we have to be honest about ourselves. But your businesses, what are they? I mean, besides remodeling and building, I thought that, but I don't know about others.
Yeah, we started in real estate. When we got out of pro baseball, we didn't know what we wanted to do, so we just got our real estate licenses, and we were armed with biblical principles because we
because
actually...
Because your dad.
Yeah.
We talked about this last time. I know your dad pretty well.
That's
well,
right.
I know him professionally.
Sure.
Flip Benham,
yeah.
A champion man
he,
in the life movement.
And he encouraged Jason and I as young kids to get into the scripture and start reading the Bible. I mean, we graduated Liberty University with American history degrees, so we had no idea about business, but we did have a bunch of time in scripture. And so our real estate company took off. It grew to 100 offices across 35 states. So we started investing in other companies. We started doing all kinds of different business that was centered around real estate with marketing and
okay.
tax and accounting and all of this. But then what we decided to do was we didn't realize we were serial entrepreneurs. It was just something that was in us. We loved the whole idea of creating jobs. So we went overseas and started creating jobs, and we had one company there that's now got almost 500 employees. And it's just, it's amazing. We went and actually visited our company over there, and they actually gave me a standing ovation because when they found out, hey, this is the owner, this is one of the guys that started the company, they gave us a standing ovation, and a young man stood up, and I was so impressed. He said, I am so thankful that you have come
and given us work. And that's an incredible thing to hear from a young man, because they value work. And that's one of the things we need to get back to in this country, really valuing work.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I did think of that as you were speaking. And Jason, are you guys, that's what we need here at home. I mean, because of all the regulations and the environmental constraints and the small the taxes and, you know, the approvals and all this, the red tape that weights anybody trying to be an entrepreneur in this country down, do you think that, do you have hope that that might change with the different administration?
Oh, well, you know it will change. I mean, the day that a president comes in, what's the trickle-down effect?
It's 4,000 federal jobs.
4,000 federal jobs, but each one of those hires, you know, 8 to 10 people, so you got thousands of jobs. So all the bureaucrats change, and that happens to be, you know, the agencies that are over, you know, businesses and regulations and all of those types of things. So I remember when David and I first started our business back in 2003, when we got to a point where we were one election in to where David and I were, I forget who, it was George Bush,
was
and I forget who he was running
Gore.
Against. It was Gore. And I remember
the Chad era.
I remember just praying. There were some things I disagreed with George Bush on, but I remember just praying and saying, God, I know that if he's the president, at least we'll have 4 years to where my business can actually flourish. So can you help
John
him
Kerry.
To get in?
Sorry, I said Gore. That was
whoever
early.
It was. John I don't Kerry. Know. But he won. So yeah, of course. You know, and small business owners especially, they are very. You know, it matters who's in office, because that's the beauty of a small government, is that we get a chance to just, hey, leave us alone, let us do our thing, we'll create jobs.
Turn you loose.
Yeah.
The problem is the narrative is that guys like us are the wealthy.
That's okay, right, so and the enemy.
They keep using the word
it must be punished.
The wealthy. Let's not give the tax breaks, or let's not give incentives to the wealthy. But the thing is it's not, our wealth is actually the generation of jobs. You can generate jobs. You're a rainmaker. You can create markets. And as a result of that, you've got so many jobs flowing, you're succeeding through others, and yes, you do yield benefit from that financially. So when you begin to actually enable the quote-unquote wealthy, which Jason and I call them job creators, when you enable job creators to exercise their giftings and abilities in a market that's not oppressive and over-regulated, man, the economy will absolutely flourish.
And the best thing to do to creative people is leave them alone. Just let them create and watch what they do.
I think some people can't conceive of the fact that business can be creative, but it is.
Business is
all about being creative. And the other thing is just the whole concept that the left thinks we have a finite amount of like jobs and money, and this group has all the jobs and money, and this group at the disadvantage or at the cost of this other huge group that's a disadvantage. But the truth is, there is limitless amounts of money and jobs if you turn entrepreneurs loose
look
to
at,
create them.
Just look at Uber. Just think of Uber and Lyft. They have created so many. I don't even know those people. I have no clue. Who knows what they believe? But either
I can
way,
tell you a few things.
But here's the thing. But the beauty of the market is that the opportunities are always out there. You have to discover them. You don't have to invent an opportunity. God's given us all the opportunities. And how many thousands and thousands and thousands of jobs they've created for these folks that just want to work for themselves and kind of, hey, give people lifts wherever they need to give them lifts and make some money off of it. It's phenomenal.
Well, part of the problem, of course, is that business in this country, there used to be a certain ethic and even a certain patriotism among, you know, moguls who own businesses. And we sort of lost that. I think big business in many cases, certainly not in all, because I know a lot of people that are wealthy who are honest, hardworking, but it has become corrupted with other interests, the international interests that have nothing to do with the country, and personal interests that really don't regard the feelings of people. Yeah. So you've got that in the mix, which has poisoned the well for capitalism.
Well, and you know, capitalism is a good thing, but capitalism, apart from being underneath the authority of God, is a very dangerous thing. It's like ambition is a good thing, but ambition void of morality is a very dangerous thing. You know, you can find somebody who's got all the smarts in the world technologically, but if he doesn't have morality, he's going to be the guy who's figuring out ways to tap into your iPad camera so that he can watch you, you know. And so that's why David and I, we talk at lots of different business events, and we say, you know, the definition of a free market and fair market value is the price a buyer is willing to pay, the price a seller is willing to sell, with a clear conscience under God. But in today's capitalistic society, we've removed the God factor. And so now we have the price a buyer is willing to pay and the price a seller is willing to sell. And when you remove underneath the clear conscience under God, then it's anything goes. And this is why you've got so many folks on the left that hate capitalism, because they're watching it void of God.
You know, interest, couple of quick stories. David Satter is a Russian expert, friend of mine, and he is he speaks fluent Russian. He lived there a number of years. He had a Russian wife. He's written a lot of books. And one of the things that he observed after the breakup of the Soviet Union was that, of course, all these business interests came in, and they began to flourish in capitalism, but there was no morality at all. And so there was raping and pillaging of the natural resources, and it was just terrible things that began to happen. So that was one. And he's not... David is Jewish, and he's a secular Jew, but his observation was the need for morality and some sort of knowledge of God. It was interesting. And the second thing is, I read in the Chicago Tribune a few years ago when I was on the radio in Chicago about a Chinese businessman after China opened up, you know, to capitalism, at least partially, and he had become a Christian, and he came to the United States to study what it meant to be a Christian businessman. He wanted to learn how that affected the decisions that you made. And it was just a whole long expose on how beneficial it was. So these are the things that Americans don't talk about anymore. They don't study economics. You guys said you studied history.
Yeah.
How did you stumble into business?
Well, we had just been studying the Bible in addition to getting our degrees. And when we got out of college, as we were playing pro baseball, Jason and I just had something inside of us where we knew... I want to do something on my own, and I want to create jobs. I don't want to just give money away, because, I mean, all people that have the Holy Spirit in them want to help others. So it's just natural in us. It's actually supernatural, that's this desire inside of us that just wants to constantly help people. And so what we thought was, if we can build a business that can create enough jobs where we can sustain families, and then those families can help other families, wouldn't that be amazing? So we just got into it. That's all we did.
Well, when we were 12 years old, we started mowing lawns in our yard. And by the time we were 15, all of our buddies were getting jobs at McDonald's and Arby's and places like that. And they were making, I think, when we were $5 or $6 an hour.
It was $4.25 an hour.
But they would work all day, like an eight-hour day, and bring home $50. And David and I, we had been mowing lawns, and we're like, man, I can make $50 in an hour. You know, we go out and hit two lawns, and we've done it. And so it caught us really early in our teenage years that we knew that if we wanted to do anything where we could be free and yet make good money to be able to get to a point where we're financially independent, we would have to own our own thing. And so that's what we did.
You guys are identical twins. Yeah.
Right.
So,
but I'm better looking. I can clearly see this.
Are you going to stand for that? You going to sit there and take that, Jason?
Just remember, the empty wagon does rattle the loudest.
That's good. All right. So I'm going to change gears a little bit, and we're going to get into this because this is going to be fun. I promise. My best friend has identical twin boys, and they, very much like you guys, they play professional volleyball. And they actually went to California when they graduated from college and played volleyball on the beach, professionals. And then one of them became a pilot who flies, it's a private company, so he flies celebrities around, like J-Lo, Barbra Streisand.
Wow.
He's got all kinds of stories. And the other one owns a financial company, so very successful. A lot of things,
and
very energetic. But there's a lot of really interesting things about them being twins. So what do you see as... even though they're identical, one has some strengths the other lacks. So how do you guys, and they complete each other. So would you say that describes you guys?
I would say, this is David, I would say that Jason is more of the mind and I'm more of the mouth. And here's what I mean.
Oh, we know what you
when,
mean.
No. When we were building our company, okay, so first of all, as kids, I would end up getting us into trouble with my mouth, whether it's on the basketball court or at the school yard, it didn't matter. But when we started our business, we would jump on an elevator at one of our biggest clients, banking clients, and we'd be heading up the elevator, and Jason would say, dude, you just open the conversation and just get everybody talking, and then when they start asking specifics, I'll take over. So every single client, I would go in, put my hand
You're
out.
You're the opener.
I would just open. I'd start talking football. I'd make fun of Jason. We'd start laughing. And then we finally would circle around to business, the task at hand, and they'd start asking specific thing about our assets or whatever it was they wanted us to liquidate. And Jason would jump in and just start talking.
You know, they did this thing at the Dixie Stampede where they were pulling all this weight with these horses. And they took, it was horses, right? Was it Clydesdales?
Yeah, horses. It was, I don't know. Quarter horses or Clydesdales. One of the two.
But this one horse that won it pulled 8,000 pounds, and the horse that took second place pulled 7,000 pounds. So the two owners got together. They said, let's put them together. Let's see how much they can pull. So they were thinking that they would pull, what is it, 15,000 pounds? Oh, sorry. Should I wrap this up?
Yeah, no, you know what? Come back to that. And, you know, listen, we're going to do one more segment, and I want to ask you questions about what it's like to be a twin. Just some fun things, and we're going to do that. I'm with David and Jason Bennett. By the way, their book is Living Among Lions. It's talking about Daniel's faithfulness in Babylon, which they could relate to because of their experience with HGTV. But we're going to talk some fun talk when we return. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Sandy Rios back with you. We're live at the Cove. And so if you hear some noise, that's because these noisy people that came to the Cove to be with us, we're having so much fun. And it's especially fun for me to interview the Bennett brothers, David and Jason. And we've been talking business and their past and all of that, but let me just say that their website is Benham Brothers, B-E-N-H-A-M, BenhamBrothers.com. They've written two books, and then, of course, there's so much to say about them, and we already said it, at least some of it. But, Jason, before the break, you were telling this great story about horses, and you're going to have to back up and tell
sure.
it again.
Sure. Well, you were asking us about being twins.
That's
and,
right.
And, you know, two can accomplish so much more than one. But at the Dixie Stampede, one horse that ended up winning this horse pull competition pulled 8,000 pounds, and the second place horse pulled 7,000 pounds. So the owners got together and they said, hey, let's get them together and watch them pull 15,000 pounds. They ended up pulling 30,000 pounds.
Are you kidding?
But that shows you what you can accomplish when you're going out more than just by yourself. We weren't created to be on our own.
Even Jesus sent the disciples out two by two.
It's true.
It's important.
Well, you know, but there is a special dynamic with twins. And you know, I don't have to tell you, but I'm telling the audience that, in case they don't know. And I find, at least with my experience with Brendan and Brad, Tim and Brendan, that they are better together. And they want to be together. They never get tired of each other. They may have arguments, you know, but they really, really feel, I think, incomplete without each other. I think they tried some time apart, but it was, did you ever do that? Did you guys ever separate and go your own way?
The only time we ever did that, we graduated from Liberty in 98, and then Jason got drafted by the Orioles. I got drafted by the Red Sox, and we parted ways for 4 years. Jason, oh, he struggled.
Hey, do you know what was funny about that, though? Was that for all my life, and even now, because David and I travel so much together, I'm so used to when I walk into a room, everybody's staring at us. And it's not staring at us because they recognize us. It's staring at us because here we are. We look just, I mean, identical. And so whenever I got into pro ball and I wasn't with him, I noticed that nobody ever looked at me. It was really weird.
Because, see,
I was like,
he can't stand on his own. He has to have Big Brother for anyone to recognize him.
I'm just talking about people in general now. There were plenty of ladies that were
come on,
way.
Shush, dude. Don't be insecure.
Well, now that's another topic. You know, when I was singing, I sang with a men's glee club when I was in college, and there were triplets in the glee club, and their names were Harold, Daryl, and Gerald.
Oh, my goodness.
And people would be sitting. They wouldn't stand together, but people would be sitting in the concert, and they'd be...
That should be a crime. Parents
they were identical. It's like, and they would think they were losing their minds. There were three boys, and the men's glee club would look just
That's
alike,
crazy.
But they were triplets.
Wow.
It was so much fun. So what was that? Did you ever feel like you needed to establish a separate identity?
No, because God made us twins. I mean, this was on him.
Well, and two, we do have our own identities. Our parents did a good job of pulling that out of both of us. You know, Dad always used to say that I was more of a thinker, And David was more of just a loudmouth.
Oh, come on.
But you know what? What's funny is that, you know, God has used a lot of loudmouths. You know, Paul, he was a loudmouth. He wasn't scared to say certain things.
Peter.
And Peter, for sure.
He's a great guy.
As well. You know, and but God uses people like that. And so I knew who I was. My dad did a good job of telling David and I, look, you guys get into the Word, get to know your Creator, and your Creator will reveal yourself to yourself. And that's how you'll find out who you are.
I'm going to pick on Brendan and Tim. They don't know I'm talking about them this morning. But I remember when they were when they were little, they would each do, well, for instance, we had a garden. And one of them went out and picked the hot peppers and rubbed his eyes and came in crying. He was just dying with the hot peppers. And about 10 minutes later, totally independently,
the other one going, he's in the hot peppers.
And that happened all the time. It wasn't like they planned it. They didn't call each other and say, let's both get in the hot peppers. But they had these, say, or they come into a room and one would say something, and a few minutes later, the other one would come into the room and say the same thing. Did you have things like
all
that happen?
All the time. As a matter of fact, we left for Chicago last week with our wives. I jumped in. I showed up at the taxi cab, and I look at Jason, and he's wearing the exact shirt, the exact shorts, and the same flip-flops. And I hadn't wore that shirt in who knows how long. I was like, look at yourself. I actually got my bag.
And he looked at you.
I opened my bag in the parking lot and switched shirts. I mean, we have done so many times.
Did your mother dress you alike?
No, she always put Jason in green and David in blue. And then we had these shirts that I don't know who they had who made these, but one said I'm Jason, he's David, and the other said I'm David, he's Jason. So when we look at pictures of ourselves way back when, none of us, not my mom, my dad, any of us know who's who really.
Even in our book, Whatever the Cost, we put pictures in there. So we and when we were filtering through the pictures to decide which ones we were going to put in the book. It was hard for us. We could not tell each other apart until our mom came and said, oh, yeah, David, that was you. I put you in that outfit.
When you were kids, though, other twin moments. Just, I'm sure your mother's told you plenty, or you remember them. Things that,
it's funny because all of our daily habits took place at the exact same time. All of our natural desires, like we were always starving at the exact same moment. So we were always making a beeline for the refrigerator.
And we both had to use the restroom at the exact same time.
Yes, so we would, and then we both had the favorite toilet. You know?
The same one I probably
had. Yeah. David is running back there to my parents' toilet. And I'm like, no, that's mine. I got to go too. You better hurry up.
So, all right, from that to this, because you're twins and because there is that intuitive thing and, you know, it's a mystery. It's sort of a mystery. It's actually a really fascinating mystery, I think, identical twins. But you both at some point in your lives came to Christ. So how did that happen? I mean, individually, what was it like for you?
Well, the very first time we ever prayed to receive Jesus in our heart was we were 6 years old at a little gym that
both of you together.
Both of us at the same time. Our dad was a pastor, so he was
doing an event or something.
We were meeting at a daycare center, and he came and talked to Jason. So we both prayed. And I remember that day because both of us were sweating. It was the first time I'd seen I was sweating so bad I had sweat running down my belly, and I felt like my dad because he always exercised. But then at the age of 12, independent, Jason was at a revival service. I was at a youth camp meeting, but we were both 12 years old, different times in our lives, and both of us came to know the Lord. Jason, when he was sitting in a chapel service, and then I was at a youth camp, and the Holy Spirit just began to convict us, and that's when we fully surrendered our lives to the Lord, made a commitment.
But you were both 12. But was it in a? I'm just trying to clarify. You were in different locations, but it was the same time.
Right.
Was there a period of time where one of you was six months apart? Yeah. So
I was at the same.
Was that weird?
I think I gave my heart to Jesus in a chapel service about 6 months before we went on this little youth retreat or whatever it was where David ended up giving his heart to
the Lord. Did that create any dissonance between you?
Oh no. I applaud our parents. Our parents never. Pitted one twin against the other and was like, hey, why don't you be more like your brother? Even though I knew that Jason was always their favorite, I didn't get into as much trouble as him. But our dad taught us one thing that was very valuable.
You're getting us confused, you know.
That's right.
That was Jason speaking.
That's right. Our dad taught us that competition is meant to build each other up. It's meant to build people up, like iron sharpening iron. It's not meant to tear down. And the way that iron sharpens iron is you remove comparison. So that's how competition can build up, is the minute you remove comparison and say, wait, you do this and I do that.
I've never thought of that.
But now that's – David and I competed against each other all the time in basketball, baseball, boxing. I knocked him flat cold one time in our backyard. So that's what the way
Did you ever get mad at each other?
Oh,
are you
kidding?
Yeah, of course. Especially when we got to be teenagers and he'd have a shirt or I'd have a tie or whatever and we'd fight over it. Because we grew up, we did not have any money. I mean, our dad never made more than $24,000 a year, despite the narrative that's out there that the Benham brothers have all the privilege and all this other stuff. We had nothing, and we grew up in a very rough part of town. So, I mean, when you had a nice shirt and it was Friday night and you were going to the football game and you had two twins and we both were the same size but only one shirt.
Well, I'll give you an example. Our dad, when he baptized Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe from Roe vs. Wade, he was on the front of Time magazine. He was wearing my shirt and David's tie.
You know, when I was in high school, I think I did a research project on the first Siamese twins. It was Chang and Ing.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they never did get separated because they didn't know how to do it. So they lived their life, and they had separate homes. They each had a different wife, and they each had like 10 or 12 kids. And they would spend like a week or two at one house and then a week or – seriously. But I remember reading about how they got in a fight, and they were fighting each other, and they fell off a truck. And, you know, so they realized that we can't fight. You know, where they were joined. Wow. It's a very interesting story.
That's wild.
Wow.
I'm going to Google that. I got to see what these guys look like.
You know, when I was your wives now. So Lori and Tori, that you didn't make that up.
No,
that is really
and they spell
funny.
It the same. Lori and Tori.
That's a little crazy.
So did you meet them in the same environment or did you meet them separately?
Well,
did they know each
David
other?
David met his wife Lori at Liberty our freshman year. And she chased me around for half a semester, realized she couldn't have me, so she had to go to second best.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then 3 years later, we were playing in a summer league in between our junior and senior year of college. And this one young girl named Tori, who ended up being my wife, her dad was the chaplain of our baseball team. And when I met her, I knew she needed me. And I was willing to fill that role.
That's right.
So, see, that's a very interesting dynamic, of course, when you fold in the wives. And because of the proximity, that can bring a lot of pressure. To wives that suddenly they have more than a husband. They've got a twin brother.
When we were building our company, we actually, Jason and I, we knew we were onto something early on. We said, I think we're going to build a pretty big company, but we had to save all of the money that we were making. So we actually moved our families in together. And at the time, I'm David. Lori and I had just, we were pregnant with our third kid, and Jason and Tori were pregnant with their second. So we had two pregnant wives with toddlers still in diapers. And we were living together. That was nuts. It lasted 6 months. There were no blow-ups. It was great. I mean, it actually, we were very civil. But I don't suggest people actually do that.
But you have to strike a balance. Okay, I'm filling in the blanks here, and you can plead the fifth. But, you know, just because you guys love each other and want to be together all the time, you can't assume that of your wives. That's kind of hard. And so, but you live on the same street,
yes.
Same block.
Five doors down.
And your wives homeschool your kids?
They do. Uh-huh. But now, we've also left and cleft, if I can use that terminology. You know, I would rather be with my wife more than I would rather be with David. And I know
he would
rather be with his wife more than he'd rather be with me.
Yeah.
But that's the leave and cleave. Now, it took some time for that. I remember when David first moved to Concord, which is just north of Charlotte where we live. And I had been married for a year. He had been married like 3 or 4 years. And it was our first time to be back together since we left each other in pro ball. And after about 6 months, I think both our wives were like, okay, all right, you guys, we have to figure this out.
Because we were going back to, we were working out at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah. We were like, hey, can David and Lori come over for dinner?
Hey, there's a football game. Let's go.
You guys have been together every night this week, so.
Yes, I remember having that happen in the other situation, too. It's hard. It's a big adjustment, but you guys have worked through it.
But our wives are very best of friends. I mean, they are very close. And you know, when you're raising children and you're homeschooling and you're loving wives or you're loving husbands that are doing the same thing and we're building the company together as families, we've gotten our families together a lot. We've done vacations together. And there's really a great connection there, almost like they're sisters.
There was a time when the kids were younger, we had to keep them apart.
because it was like nitro and glycerin.
It's all of our kids getting together, and you've got one pulling one's hair and another one throwing a toy, and it's like the moms are like, wait, your kid was, you know, and it's, but now,
I bet they're very close. They will be very close.
Oh, they're very close.
Yeah.
Do you realize that the siblings or the cousins of twins are closer in DNA to brother and sister than they are to cousins? I never knew that. Somebody found that. Yeah, it was crazy, this scientific research.
No, I would not know that. Well, all right. You guys, this has been so much fun. David and Jason Benham, what's next for you guys? Another business, another book?
We're still building business. I mean, we've got all of our companies are still running, the real estate company and everything else. So we're entrepreneurs, but we're also constantly speaking and working on another book, but we haven't fully decided which direction we're going to go.
It'll probably be on work, business, how to make your work worship.
Oh, I like that. You know what? I think you should write about what you said about competition.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody really taught.
We'll
that's a great thought. The competition is that God gave us that proclivity to make us each better. That makes so much sense. I'd never thought of it. Love it. So
awesome.
I won't forget that. All right, David and Jason Benham. It's BenhamBrothers.com. BenhamBrothers.com. Their books, Living Among Lions and Whatever the Cost. And you guys, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us. You're
an
awesome interview.
Oh, well, you're very sweet. All right, let's go have dinner. All right, thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Monday is the, we'll be talking about the debate that's going to take place on Sunday night between Donald Trump and, Hillary Clinton. So that should be interesting, so be sure and stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.